This is Dave Crippen at the Archives of the Henry Ford Museum. We are conducting another one of our interviews in our design oral history series. And today we're speaking with Fritz Mayhew, who is currently design executive for Luxury Car Exterior. And we'd like Mr. Mayhew to tell his story pretty much in his own words.
Thank you, Dave. Well, I would say that my background is probably very similar to most automotive designers that you're going to be interviewing. I just was always interested in cars, always liked them. My mother still has sketches around the house that I did of cars when I was very young. And but I was also just generally interested in art, and I found myself drawing horses and cartoons and you name it when I was in grade school. But when I entered high school, I really had no desire to become an automotive designer. In fact, at that time, I think the thing to be was an engineer. So I was in an engineering-related course in high school, lots of math and very little art, almost none. And it was near the end of my senior year when I began to realize that math really wasn't my strongest suit. It was okay, but I wasn't great. And I started to look around for some other profession that might apply better to what I could do. And for some reason, I just got interested in industrial design, because that's kind of a field that combines a little bit of the engineering approach with an artistic approach. And it just seemed like it might work for me. I wasn't really sure. But I applied to several schools that majors in industrial design. I applied to Syracuse University. And I also applied to the Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh, which is a local school for me that had a very good reputation. And I was accepted at both schools, and I went to I decided to go to Carnegie Mellon for a variety of reasons, but one of them was financial. It just made more sense for me to do that. And it turned out that the school had a very interesting industrial design program that was one of the first in the country, actually, industrial design. And a lot of the professors that were there when I was there were professors that actually started the program. So I got what you'd call, I guess, a very classic industrial design education. Lots of good, solid problem-solving skills. And lots of personal attention, because the industrial design department was relatively small. I think we started with something like 13 students in my class, and I think only 8 of us graduated. But in addition to all of that nicely organized industrial design background, Carnegie Tech also had a very strong art department, very strong. And the first 2 years of school were devoted to a very heavy fine arts curriculum. Did a lot of figure drawing, a lot of painting, sculpture. And that's when my artistic ability sort of came through, because I found I was very good at it. The experience, or the event that got me interested in automotive design, happened in my between my junior and senior years. It just so happened that General Motors decided that they should, well, they've, I guess I should backtrack a little bit. General Motors had been having for several years a summer program for college students, where they would bring in students from automotive design schools for a 3-month program in their advanced design area. And this particular year, they decided that they would like to take a look at bringing some students in who had no automotive design background at all. So they went to schools that didn't really teach or major, have any majors in automotive design. And I was selected, which I thought was great, because it was a good job, the salary was terrific, and it sounded like fun.
Excuse me, was there an automotive design curriculum at Carnegie Mellon?
Not at all. No, not at all. It was almost a dirty word. Automotive design was a dirty word. And I think one of the reasons was that it was strictly an industrial design school. And automotive design was kind of on the fringe of industrial design. You know, it didn't really have the respect within the profession that it should. Nevertheless, I went to the summer program.
This was in the summer of 1962?
This was in 62, summer of 62, between my junior and senior years. And it was just a tremendous experience. It was a real eye-opener because it was at the General Motors Technical Center, which is just a beautiful environment, very contemporary at the time, and extremely exciting. It was almost like designer heaven, really it was. And it was a great program. It was well done. We got lots of exposure to some of the very best designers that General Motors has. It was a nicely organized project. And I guess the bottom line is I just loved it. I really did. But I realized when I was exposed to some of the professionals there, automotive design professionals, that I was lacking some skills, rendering skills, illustration skills. But just the exposure gave me a chance to see what I needed. And so I just worked on that during my senior year.
Can you tell us a little bit about the curriculum at the Summer Automotive Design Program at GM? What sort of exercises they had to do?
It was very well organized. We had a specific problem to work on, fairly well defined. I'm trying to remember what we had to do. We had to do a four-passenger car for the 80s or something like that. I can't remember what. But they did a good job. They gave us a lot of freedom to develop our own packages. They brought in some experts to talk to us, some engineering people. Mm-hmm. We even had a little bit of aerodynamics even back then. They talked a little bit about that. And so they gave us a little bit of background, and then we had sort of orderly reviews of our sketches, and then we selected a design direction, and we proceeded with a 1/5 scale model. We worked with a modeler who was a trainee. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the summer, we had a presentation of our models and our sketches.
And a critique
by the top management there. And at that time, it was Chuck Jordan was the guy who reviewed our models. And I believe Bill Mitchell came through also. And as a matter of fact, as a result of that, I must have done a good job because they gave me a scholarship. I got a General Motors scholarship for my senior year, which is probably a good sign. At that time, I really was interested in automotive design, decided that's what I really wanted to do. Because I felt I could see I was going to be comfortable doing it. So anyway, I had this scholarship, and at the end of the year, when I graduated, I was interviewed by General Motors and by Ford. And as a matter of fact, those were the days when companies were recruiting very aggressively. I can still remember General Motors flying me to Detroit for my interview, picking me up at the airport in a limousine, you know, driving me out to the tech center for this interview. All pretty heady stuff, you know, for a kid from Pittsburgh with very little exposure outside of that town.
They thought they had a lock on you because of the scholarship, perhaps.
Well, the indication was that they probably did. Now, the question is, why did I go to Ford Motor Company? Various reasons, I think.
Why didn't you go to GM, I guess we should ask.
Well, my decision was based more on the fact that I felt there were more opportunities at Ford at the time. Ford, at that stage, the company was becoming very aggressive, I thought, from a design standpoint. As I was graduating, they had a series of show cars out, Mustang, I forget what it was. They had a rear-engined Mustang 1, I think they called it, that was a very exciting car. When I did come to Dearborn on my own and interviewed at Ford.
No airplane.
No, I drove up myself. But they seemed to have an attitude that they really wanted new people more than General Motors did. General Motors always seemed to have the attitude that, yes, if you're interested, we'd like to have you. But they weren't, I don't know, I just had the impression that the opportunities were there at Ford and that the company was becoming more and more aggressive. And that was just before they introduced the original Mustang. That had been designed before I arrived, but that car was there, and I just felt that things were going to happen at Ford. And they were really expanding their design department at that time, too.
We have the impression that the regiment at the tech center is rather not quite as loose or with the same camaraderie that you...
At the time, I had the impression that there was very much a General Motors way, and that all of the designers fit into a very small mold. They were all very similar, all very talented.
Yeah.
It seemed that I could even sense that they had a tremendous backlog of talent there. And you're right, although I didn't realize at the time, I've since found that that's absolutely true, that the group of designers at Ford generally tend to be a little looser. It's a less formalized kind of environment. I've certainly met a lot of nice people while I've been at Ford. Just generally a nice group of people that I've enjoyed. Well, I'm not sure I was aware of that at the time. I was interviewed by, Buzz Grissinger.
Oh, yes.
Hopefully you'll have a chance to interview him. He's retired, but quite a guy.
California, yeah.
Yeah. And he was head of Lincoln Mercury Design at the time. And extremely impressive guy. He's has a lot of stature, and he's a very handsome guy, and chiseled features, and he had this sort of gray flowing hair, and his collar stood up about 3 inches above his suit, you know, and he was just a real impressive guy, and very nice. And he took more interest in my portfolio, I think, than anybody. I mean, he really seemed to be enjoying looking at it, and he really paid attention, asked a lot of questions. I felt like he really cared. I guess all of that added up to that making that decision. So when I started at Ford, by the way, I married my childhood sweetheart at that time, a neighbor that we've been going together for a long time. We went to school together, as a matter of fact. She was an art major also. And we came to Detroit. We sort of started everything at once. We graduated in May, I guess. We got married in August. I came to work almost immediately, right in the 1st of June. Married in August, and really jumped into the middle of it at Ford Styling, because it was a different kind of place at that time in the early 60s. It was much larger than it is now. I don't know the exact numbers. The staff was huge.
Over 1,000.
Yeah. And the pace was incredible. We were working overtime 4 nights a week and Saturdays. And we did that for several years, and we would work 5 hours of overtime a night. And this is the entire building, and 8 hours on Saturday. Now, it's a good thing I was young and had just been married, because I could never do that now. And I don't know how people did. It was an incredible, incredible time. I think that went on for almost 5 years.
What do you attribute that frenetic pace to?
Well, I think it's a variety of things, looking back on it. They had an organizational system there. They had several design directors. They had a Lincoln design director of Lincoln Mercury, that was Buzz Grissinger. They had Joe Orris, you know, another classic automotive designer. He was in charge of the Ford studio. Dave Ash was there at the time. He was, at that time, Special Vehicles, which was kind of an advanced design area.
Later Interiors.
Later Interiors. Damon Woods was interior design.
Uh-huh. How about Dean Bordenave?
Bordenave was the vice president.
Did you get a chance to meet him?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Very impressive guy, by the
yes.
way.
Yeah.
He was a kind of a charismatic guy. You couldn't help but like him, really. He has a way about him.
The Walker era had ended.
Walker era had ended.
Yeah, although Joe Orr was in, I guess Elwood Engel had stayed on for a time.
Elwood Engel was gone at that time.
By the time you got there?
Yeah.
He left in 61.
That's right. But each of these directors seemed to be a very powerful individual, and all very different. And at that time, they had the manpower available that allowed them to, all of them, to compete for almost every individual design. In other words, if we were doing a new Ford or a new Mercury, every studio would put together full-size clay proposals. And makes a tremendous manpower requirement to do that. And I can remember shows, we have a courtyard in the middle of the Design Center outdoor display area, where there would be 20 clay models out there up for approval. And it was very exciting for a young designer, because with all these clay models being done, you had a pretty good chance of having a lot to do with at least one of them, you know. So it was a time when there was a tremendous amount of work being done and a lot of internal competition, which was fun. Mm-hmm. But it generated a tremendous amount of work, as you can imagine. That was part of it. Mm-hmm. But it was fun. Mm-hmm. It's never been the same since that.
That's exciting.
Extremely exciting. Yeah. And of course, it seemed like we were always doing new programs. They were retooling and facelifting all the time. There must have been a tremendous amount of money to spend. And on top of that, we had people like Lee Iacocca, who were extremely aggressive. And there were just a lot of powerful personalities there at the time. And it was a very exciting time to be involved in the business. And the time flew by quickly, I must say. Mm-hmm. Looking back on what I've done, I can't really remember any specific major programs I worked on. I just worked on a lot of them. And besides, Ford had this training program for the first 2 years where you rotated between the studios, and you rotated every 6 months, which was great for a young designer. You got to meet the different managers, and you got exposed to a lot of different disciplines, and it was, and that was, by the way, looking back on, another reason why I came to Ford, because they had that training program. Mm-hmm. At General Motors, you spent 6 months in a training studio, and then they assigned you to a program studio, and that was pretty much it for your career.
Yeah.
I felt that you would be. And at Ford, they had this training program where you rotated, and you got a lot of exposure, and it gave you a chance to be sure that was what you wanted to do.
Who headed up the training program?
No one, really.
No one?
It was just an organized, informal rotational program.
Yeah. What assignments did you have in this early period?
You know, I can't even remember. You spent some of your time in interiors, some of your time in exteriors. When I finally settled down and got a permanent assignment, I was in the International studio, which was really an advanced design area, and we were kind of a catch-all studio. We really ended up working on a lot of various production programs in addition to advanced things, because the same system was in place. If there was a need for a new something, everybody would do one.
I noticed you have some position descriptions here in terms of Illustrator A and Designer A. How did that work?
Oh, that was just the Illustrator A was the bottom of the barrel, you know.
Right.
That was kind of a training position.
Uh-huh.
And however, in those days, because of the place was expanding, there was a lot of movement and a lot of chances for promotion. And I kind of walked up the ladder relatively quickly in relationship to what it takes today, I'm afraid. But, I guess I'm looking at this thing now. In a year, I was a Designer A, which is just kind of a recognition that you've passed, you know, you've been accepted into the ranks of a real designer. And then a year later, I was made a Senior Designer. And I thought things were going along just fine. Went through a number of studios, and then a strange thing happened. I was transferred to the Corporate Identity Office, which is... at that time, we had a corporate identity office, not in the Design Center, but it was in the World Headquarters building.
Who headed that up in those days?
Well, first it was headed up by Bob Zokas.
Really?
Who was also a designer.
Uh-huh.
Bob was sent over there, and their assignment was to develop a corporate identity program for Ford Motor Company, and included developing the signage for the dealerships. They did all of the... corporate graphics. Mm-hmm. They developed the letterhead. They redid the Ford Oval. They were just involved in all the corporate identity programs. Well, they also had they had some graphics people on the staff. It was a relatively small staff, maybe five or six people. Mm-hmm. So I was sent over there, and I thought, boy, this is it. My career is over. I've been sent ostracized, you know, to the world headquarters. Although I enjoyed it, and with my industrial design background, I had a lot of graphics, and I was comfortable there. It was not a difficult job. But I was only there for 3 months, and they called me back, and that's when I received a promotion to design manager. And I'm trying to figure out how old I was there. I was relatively young at the time. And then I cycled
about
through...
About 25.
Yeah, and I cycled through a whole series of exterior studios. I should mention, by the way, I guess I can back up a little bit, that I did have a year, just prior to being sent to this corporate identity office, I had a year in Europe at Ford of Great Britain.
Was this a direct offshoot of your work in international design?
Not really, not really. It was a period when... it was a time when the American approach to automotive design was really the dominant approach worldwide. And they were sending a lot of our designers to Europe. In fact, I'm trying to think who was. At that time, Damon Woods had been sent to, he was then vice president of design at Ford of Europe. Bob Thomas was a manager I'd worked for once, was sent over to be executive designer, Ford of Great Britain. And there were a number of younger designers that were sent. I went over with a team of three.
Remember who they were?
Yeah, it was Howard Rees was one of the guys. He's since left the company. Darwin Hawthorne. The three of us went together as a team to Great Britain. There were also several guys sent to Germany at that time. And really, looking back on it, we were sent there to kind of help them along. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the illustration skills that we did. They didn't have the training or the schools mm-hmm. in Europe that we had in the United States. And I think that was our purpose, was to just kind of bring them along and show them what we could do and get that good old American influence over there in Europe. And it was a great time. We had a wonderful time. We were all young, all about the same age, with either young families or no children. Our daughter was 1 year old at that time. We had one daughter at that time.
What was the What was the Ford of England or the Ford of Europe design set up in those days? Besides,
let's see.
Usually there would be an American manager come over.
Well, as I said, Damon Woods at that time was the vice president of design.
Ah.
And as an American. We had two executive designers in Britain. We had one Englishman, I'm trying to think of his name, and then we had Bob Thomas, who was an American.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were several studios within Ford of Great Britain that were run by British managers. And then they sort of pushed us in at the bottom of the pile there, the young Americans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I made a lot of friends there, and I still see them today. But as far as I, you know, I'm not really sure how Germany was organized at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We did both interior and exterior design in Great Britain at that time. Now currently, almost all of the exterior design is done in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the interior design is done in Great Britain. They've almost split it that way. But at the time, we were doing both in Great Britain. And that time went so fast, really. That year went by just like that. And I was back over here, and then I had that corporate identity thing. And
was this the first attempt at the early escort? Your year in Britain, was that?
We were doing some interesting programs. This was when they were beginning to form the Ford of Europe organization. And when I came to Great Britain, there were several interesting projects going on. They had just finished the new Escort, not the one that we know today, but
the British one.
They were in the process of completing the European Capri, which was a car that had been designed in the United States, and the design was sent to Europe in the form of a full-size fiberglass model, and it was accepted or forced upon European management as sort of their Mustang.
Mm.
And it was a very American looking sort of car that was very successful. And I was working on that program. My only contribution to that program was the side window pattern, the DLO we call it, the side windows, had what we called a hockey stick design in the U.S. It was a design line that just swept through from the belt and then it hooked up, much like today's Cougar, our current Cougar. very controversial design because it created a huge C-pillar, and rear visibility was almost impossible. And in Europe, that's a little more important than it is to us. You know, styling at the time was all that was important. And there was a lot of concern about this window pattern. It was a very distinctive one also. And my major contribution was to develop a new window pattern, which was just a very long, sweeping curve. And my inspiration was an Oldsmobile that had just been done in the United States. I wish I could remember the exact year. It must have been something around a 67 or 68 Oldsmobile. And that was incorporated into the car, my one contribution to that design. And we were also working on the new Cortina at that time, which came out after I left, but was a design that really was long-lived. And that design lasted for, gosh, 10 years with a couple of facelifts. Yeah, very successful car, that Capri, or Cortina. So it was a busy time, very, very fast, and
productive.
And very productive. And then when I look back on what happened between then and I was sort of writing down what were the milestones in my career. The next event that pops up comes up in 1976. It was a period when we were just beginning to do the early stages of the design of the 1979 Mustang. And the Mustang had had some ups and downs, as you know. We had starting with the 64. We'd gone through a whole series of Mustangs after that, all of them getting sort of larger and heavier, and then we made a quick turnaround and did the downsized Mustang II that was under Lee Iacocca. So the car had, its image had changed, and the Mustang name was still alive and very powerful, but this was the beginning of the 79 Mustang program, and it was, I put it down as one of the milestones in my career because at that time Jack Telnack came back from Ford of Europe. He had been vice president of design over there.
Succeeding
Damon, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Damon was killed in an automobile accident.
Oh.
And I'm not sure if Jack came in there immediately. He had been in Australia, chief designer or vice president down there, and then went to Europe. And he's a guy that I didn't really know very well, just heard of him because he had been in various European assignments. And he came back, and they formed a new studio, and they called it Special Vehicle and Advanced Concepts Design. And Jack Telnack was the director of that studio. Bob Zokas was the design executive. And they had two design managers in the studio, Toshi Saito and myself. And there was a sense that the reason Jack Telnack was brought back was that to bring this European influence, and it was a time of change in automotive design, at least at Ford. For me, when I'm looking back on it, it really did mark a time when there was a dramatic change in direction within design at Ford Motor Company. Jack came back, and almost immediately there was a sense that there was going to be a change and that he was going to be doing things differently. And that's exactly what happened. We started our design process in an unusual way. The timing was tight, and there must have been a delay in his ability to get back here because we were designing almost by telephone and the mail system, because he gave us an assignment to develop some proposals. We did some full-size tape drawings, had them photographed, sent the photos to Europe, then he got back with us by phone, gave us a critique, selected some designs, got us started on some directions, and we were sort of well on our way before he actually arrived. And both Toshi and myself were doing two Mustang proposals. And it was very interesting because you could sense Jack came back with this European approach to design, which many of us within the design center were enthusiastic about. It involved such things as the total absence of chrome, the real concern for aerodynamics. Now, we had been involved with aerodynamics somewhat, but we'd never really designed a car with having aerodynamics be one of the major design criteria. And that's the approach we took on this on the Mustang we did. This Mustang was based on the Fairmont, by the way, chassis.
Right.
And
is that known as the Fox platform?
Fox platform.
Yeah.
And the first thing we did was negotiate some changes in the package. We asked them to raise the cowl point, which is the base of the windshield. It's kind of an unheard of thing to do, but we asked them to raise the cowl because that gave us a hood that sloped very dramatically at the front. There had been an edict within the company. I don't know if it came from Gene Bourdonnais or if it came from Lee Iacocca, or I don't know where it came from, that fenders and belt lines should be level for as long as possible, you know, that they should never go downhill. Now, it was clearly a trend, you know, there was no mystery that the cars were becoming more wedge-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
But someone up there didn't like wedges, you know, that was just it, you know, we just never got to do a wedge. And of course, it was driving the designers nuts because we could see that trend was very strong. The car we did was a wedge-shaped car for its time, very dramatically wedge-shaped. Doesn't appear so now, but it was quite a departure. We were competing against several other studios, and also at that time we were competing against the GEA operation. They were developing some Mustang proposals too.
Was this a deliberate attempt by the administration to foster competition?
Yes, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. But somehow Jack prevailed, and we retained the wedge, and our design was it was so dramatically different from anything else that was being done. Because all of the other cars were very evolutionary kinds of Mustangs, with the usual sort of Mustang mouth and the headlamps on either side. They were rather heavily laden with chrome, and they didn't have that despised wedge, you know, they were nice and level. And we had our review, first review, and Jack we had an ace in the hole, because Bill Burke had also just come back from Europe, and he was, I'm not sure what his position was in Europe, whether it was chairman or president or whatever, but he'd just been brought back to the U.S. He was the current rising star, quite an interesting guy. And he and Jack had worked together before, both in Australia and in Europe, so I guess Jack had a little bit of an inside track to the way Bill Burke thought. And consequently, our design became the favorite. And I could see the other designs beginning to pick up a bit of our cues. Some of the hood lines started to run downhill a little bit, and some of the chrome went away. But we prevailed, and we went into some market research early, or at that stage in the program, with some full-size models. And we did very well. And we were doing, at that time, a notchback design. The car was only going to be a notchback. As you know, it ended up with a three-door fastback design and a notchback design. We were doing a notchback. And
describe a notchback.
Notchback. Notchback would be a car with a very stiff, well, we call it formal backlight in profile. It could also be called a three-box design in silhouette, where there's a definite hood, a central body, or a greenhouse, a roof, and a deck, a traditional deck, versus a fastback.
Where does the notch term come in?
Notchback? I don't know. That's just kind of a little bit of jargon there. I don't know. Notchback. But it's a formal backlight with a traditional trunk. There was a car done by the GEA Studios, a very nice-looking car that had a very attractive fastback design. And we elected to do a second model that combined the front end and the center body sheet metal of our notchback with this fastback quarter panel that was done on the GEA model. And it came out very well. And
were you able to, in effect, cannibalize other people's designs without any problem? Everybody.
Cannibalize. I wouldn't say cannibalize.
But
it was.
But were you able to?
There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that. I'm not sure from a philosophical design standpoint, I agree with that, but there was a lot of take this front end and take that rear end. Not that this particular fastback worked very well with our design. We did both cars. They ended up in research, and they both researched very well.
What does that mean? I ended up in research.
Market research.
Oh, beg your pardon. Yeah.
Market research.
The surveys came off positive.
Came off very positively. There was a period during the development of the notchback where the Mustang had traditionally, the last few Mustangs had had very stiff notchback designs with very flat backlights. And we had done one with a very...
Can you explain the term backlight?
Oh, I'm sorry, backlight. The rear window
okay. Is
the backlight. Mustangs traditionally had a very flat, squared-off rear window. And when you look down on the car, it was very flat in plan view. That's the looking down there. And our proposal had a very rounded plan view, a very rounded backlight with a notched back, kind of a formal C-pillar. And a number of the planners thought that we should do a more traditional Mustang backlight. But again, aerodynamics worked for us because we did an aero test of the flat notched back versus our very rounded one. And there was a significant reduction in drag with the rounded backlight.
How did you perform this aero test?
We, at that time, were testing mainly in 3/8 scale.
Mm-hmm.
At a wind tunnel in Maryland, University of Maryland, which we still use.
Mm-hmm.
And in that small scale, we're able to make changes very quickly. Mm-hmm. Very easy to do. And the results are surprisingly accurate. The correlation between 3/8 and full size is very good.
It seems to be a standard industry size.
The 3/8?
Yeah.
If you're going to ask me why, I don't know. I'm not sure it's a standard. When I was at GM, they were working in 5th scale.
No, you mentioned that. Yeah.
I don't know if they do that in their aero testing or not. I don't think there's not a mathematical reason for 3/8. It just seems as a convenient scale. It's a convenient size.
Was it 3/8 clay?
3/8 clay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in 3/8, you can bring one clay into the tunnel, and you can design it so that the rear end portion, or the roof, let's say, can be removed, and another one put on the car, and then that aero tested. And as I said, it's very easy to make changes. And we finally got that car down. I'm trying to remember the drag. Coefficient of drag on our final Mustang was something in the area of 3.6, I think, 0.36, which by today's standards isn't very low, but at the time it was the lowest car that Ford Motor Company made.
This was 1976 in your...
That's right.
The fuel crisis is still with us, pretty much.
Yeah, it sure was.
Yeah.
It sure was. So aerodynamics at that time had become more important because we discovered that we could, in fact, improve our CAFE average through the use of aerodynamics.
CAFE?
The federally mandated corporate average fuel economy. And we got a credit for a reduction in drag. So we could, in fact, reduce our declared fuel economy numbers by having an improvement in aerodynamics. And that became very important because we were spending millions on powertrains to improve our fuel economy. And I forget the figures, but a tenth of a mile per gallon was an extremely expensive thing to attain. And of course, it was virtually free with aerodynamics. And I think a 10% reduction in drag gives you something like a 2% improvement in fuel economy. Now, 10% reduction in drag is a hard one to get. That's a very dramatic reduction. But because of that, aerodynamics just became more and more important. And it became a very useful tool for the designer. It's one of the first times we've been able to justify a design with something that was factual rather than just saying, well, we like it and it should be this way. We could say it looks this way because it improves the aerodynamics. And, of course, it's become just more and more important. It hasn't stopped. That was the first car where it really became important. It was really one of the major design influences was aerodynamics.
This is an important juncture, I think, because aerodynamics had been around for decades.
Yeah, it had.
But it just hadn't been fashionable. But suddenly, it's not only fashionable, it's economic.
It's economical, yeah. It became very important to the corporation to reduce drag on its cars. Yes, it had been around a long time. But... you know, they had so many early disasters with aero cars. We all know about them, the Chrysler Airflow and others.
We're talking about public acceptance.
Public acceptance, right. Yeah. And it just wasn't important. And especially with our speed limits, the combination of all of the abundance of fuel and the fact that compared to Europe, our speed limits are rather low, aerodynamics just wasn't an important factor for us. I think we were the public was buying stand-up grill shells and hood ornaments and vinyl roofs, you know, and lots of chrome and fake wire wheels. And really, aerodynamics wasn't a factor.
Can you stop for a moment and maybe trace for our audience the growth of aerodynamics in Britain or in Germany? You did mention something about the speed limits there.
Well, you know, I guess I can't really chronologically tell you what.
No, just perhaps a capsulized impression.
Let me see if I can put that together there. Because of their speed limits, I mean, they travel at very high speeds, especially in Germany. On the Autobahn.
Over 100.
Yeah, over 100 is normal, and in the fast lane, you know, it's whatever you'd like.
140.
Yeah, and when you drive over there, a low-powered automobile, and of course, their economy being somewhat different than ours at the time, not as affluent, and fuel being very expensive, and the fact that they drive at high speeds. When you drive a low-powered car, and you drive it as fast as you can possibly drive it, you're very aware of the fact that the aerodynamics are important. You can really feel this poor car pushing against the air. So consequently, they became interested in aerodynamics long before we did, and you could see it in their designs. In fact, the French firm Citroën did some extremely, I think, beautiful aerodynamic designs in the 60s. And Mercedes began to pioneer, I thought, in terms of the form development, this interest in aerodynamics. And of course, the Porsches, the early Porsches, the 911s, were extremely aerodynamic automobiles. And they just got into that aerodynamic phase sooner than we did. I'm trying to pinpoint exactly when it became important. I can remember reading in magazines in the 70s, comparison tests, European magazines, where they'd actually checked the drag coefficients of various cars. Now, that was unheard of for us. In fact, we're still not doing that.
Really a racing concept in America, almost.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I guess they just got ahead of us there because their conditions were different. And
their economic conditions.
Economic, the driving conditions. Even the interest in the automobile is more of a machine than a piece of fashion. That's all part of that
right.
European, especially the Germanic approach to automotive design. It's a machine to them. And if the machine works better with good aerodynamics, then it should have good aerodynamics.
The heck with fashion.
Well, it becomes the fashion. I mean, the integrity of the machine, in a way, the design integrity, is the fashion, becomes the fashion. That's, to me, that's kind of the German approach to design. So the combination, I guess, of that and the French influence just gave them a head start in that aero development. But we have done a remarkable job of catching up. I know technically our aerodynamicists at Ford are probably the best in the world, most highly sophisticated. I mean, we invested a lot of money in the program. And we've done a tremendous amount of research, and we're developing new techniques all the time. It's become just a big piece of our design. We're now into the stage where we're testing our cars by hanging them upside down in the wind tunnel so we can see the airflow underneath the automobile. Now, that's in the past, you know, the underside of the car was really the engineer's side. We didn't get involved at all. It wasn't our business, but we're getting under there now. You know, we haven't gotten to the stage where we have full belly pans yet, but we're beginning to do partial belly pans, and we're beginning to realize that you can actually streamline suspension components and fuel tanks. And do a lot of aerodynamic tuning on the bottom of the car, in addition to the top. And it has a very dramatic effect on the drag. So I can just see more and more development along that line. Because the benefits are not only this fuel economy thing, but there are things like wind noise and stability that are provided by good aerodynamics. It's certainly become a major influence. So as I was saying, this Mustang was sort of the first aero car, where aero was really important to Ford, anyway, on a production car, where we made an issue of it, and we advertised it. And we followed with a series of cars. Our Escort that came out in 81, which I worked on that program too, was relatively good aerodynamically. That also was an interesting program. The 81 Escort, the new front-wheel drive Escort, was a joint program between Ford of Europe and Ford USA. And it was initially to be a world car, one car for Europe and the U.S. And we had kind of a friendly design competition going with the designers in Europe at that time. We were both working on the same package, basically. They, of course, felt that we couldn't possibly do a car that would sell in Europe, and we felt they couldn't do one that would sell in the USA. We did market research. We brought all of the cars, both to the U.S. for research, and we took ours to Europe for research. It turned out that the results were, the designs were close, but in fact, the U.S. car researched a little stronger in Europe, or in the U.S., and the European car researched somewhat stronger in Europe.
Again, these are surveys.
These are surveys, market research surveys. We also began to run into a problem in making a world car in that the different countries still had different requirements. In the USA, we needed air conditioning on a large percentage of our cars. We needed automatic transmissions on a large percentage. We had different rust corrosion requirements. We had different plant facilities. We weren't able to make the cars identical, and slowly they began to pull apart. And even though they look the same today, they're very different automobiles. So we ended up with two separate Escorts rather than a world, so-called world car, unfortunately. We followed that program with the development of the EXP, which was a sporty two-seater derivative of the Escort, front-wheel drive car. That was probably one of the most frustrating programs I've ever worked on, because it was a program that was done on a shoestring in a way, and we had to sort of do a sporty car based on our Escort, which is not sporty, but more boxy and tall. And we had to share a common door, front door, between the two cars. And it was a frustrating attempt to do a car that was competing with some very beautiful sports cars, and yet base it on sort of a bread-and-butter economy car.
What cars was it competing
with? Well, at the time, you know, you could say that it would compete... it could compete with cars like the Mazda RX-7.
The what?
Mazda RX-7.
Mm-hmm.
It overlapped a little bit into the... There's a Fiat X19 was out there. I'm trying to think what General Motors may have had at that time that would be competitive. I can't be specific. I think the disappointment in the car was that it didn't really deliver on the promise in a way. And on top of the sort of the styling compromises we had to make, it just had the Escort powertrain, which is not the... Come with the Turbo Sense, which has really helped the car in terms of performance. And we sort of improved the car in terms of appearance, too.
Didn't go very well. The sales were disappointing.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of program you like to work on with a bunch of givens that... The latest program that I've been involved in was the exact opposite, and probably the most exciting thing I've ever worked on is the Taurus family of cars, which is our new, all new, from the ground up, front-wheel drive, family-sized car.
Due in
86. And I think it's going to represent a real high watermark for Ford design. It happened at a time when management was encouraging us to reach as far as we could, that it was important that our cars have an individual identity. In fact, I can remember Don Peterson saying, the last thing I want these cars to look like is some other domestic car. I want them to be truly unique and to make a statement. because they're going to deliver on the promise. The car mechanically is going to be superb. So that Taurus program, probably the most exciting program I've worked on as a designer. Again, similar to the experience when Jack Telnak returned from Europe and they formed a special studio. They formed another new studio. We called it pre-programmed design.
When was this set up?
This was set up in early 1981. And again, they brought a designer from Europe. It was Ray Everts, who had been chief designer Ford of Europe. He came back and became the director of design for this pre-programmed studio. I was promoted to the position of design executive, and we both worked for Bob Zokas, who also had another area that he covered. And it was a unique studio because it was the first time that both the interior and the exterior were done under one management team. Ray and Bob and I were charged with doing both the outside and the inside of the car. You know, normally the interior design is done separately from the exterior. This was it's a designer's dream, really, to be responsible for the entire vehicle. And especially when you're starting from the ground up with an all-new car. And we started early enough where we could even have an influence on the actual package, the proportions of the car, the size of it. So we really did start right from the beginning.
The package as a styling design term is the...
It's the architecture of the car. It's the basic interior dimensions. It's the seating requirements. It's the engine, the dimensions of the engine compartment and the mechanical components, the basic wheelbase, the basic outline of the car is the package, the basic engineering definition of the car. What are the interior dimensions? How much is the headroom? It's the width of the interior. It's the basic. It performs the basic outline of the car. That's the package. And once the package is established,
who establishes that package?
The design center does.
Okay. Good.
We have responsibility for package design. So we develop the package, we establish it, and then we execute it. But it's a critical stage, is this package development stage. And I think the first thing we did, there had been a package, preliminary package had been developed that had a 103-inch wheelbase, because everyone was downsizing. We could see the trend toward downsizing, but no one was sure exactly how much to downsize. And we did a very elaborate display that showed Ford cars, what size they are now and what size they were going to be through 1986 and 87 versus where we thought the competition was going to be. And we found that our car was going to be somewhat too small against the competition. And there was a big gap in our range between this 103 and then our next car, which was, trying to think what it was, we were still going to be producing some cars with 112-inch wheelbases. Mm-hmm. So we proposed that the wheelbase be increased and that the car be stretched somewhat. And that was accepted, even though at the time it was a weight penalty. You know, the other side of the coin in fuel economy, aerodynamics is one tool, but weight reduction is another one. And that was a pressure that was asking us to make the car smaller. So that 3 inches of wheelbase increase had a significant effect on the weight, but it was just, everyone agreed that it was required. So we started from that base, just established that package, and then began to develop our designs. And we were receiving constant pressure from Don Peterson to reach out and do something really dramatically different.
Peterson at that time what was his position?
Peterson was president.
President 81?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
He had been in product planning and international ideas.
Right. But, yeah, to the best of my knowledge, he was president at that time. And he was working very hard, I think, to change the philosophy of Ford Motor Company, the kind of cars we build. He was very much involved in the car as a machine and building a driving machine, not just a piece of fashion. And this emphasis on functional design, combined with this need to reach, I think, pushed us to do some of the most beautiful cars we've done. They're dramatically different. They are very soft in form. They are extremely aerodynamic.
And light.
And they're very light. They have generous interior packages. We did a Ford and a Mercury, the two car lines. We tried to give them distinctly different images. The Mercury was to be a very sophisticated, high-tech kind of a car to really appeal to the guy who may be looking at a BMW.
You're still talking about the Taurus program?
Still talking about Taurus program. Taurus was the code name for the Ford and the Mercury replacements. And the Ford was to be a car that, yes, was contemporary, but somehow appealed just a little bit more to the traditional American buyer, but one that would also be looking at a European model also. So the cars were very, they had what I would call an international look about them. They do have an international look about them.
These were planned as replacements for the Tempo Topaz?
No. These were planned as replacements for the, they were at that time planned as replacements for the full-size Ford and Mercury.
Ah.
Our bread-and-butter car.
Right.
These were it. That's why it was such an important program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising how much freedom the company allowed us as designers, because considering how important those cars are to Ford Motor Company's well-being, we had a tremendous amount of freedom. It was just a real exciting time period.
Mm-hmm.
I wish you could see the cars. They really are something. The
seems some spy photos.
Yeah. The Mercury, which is really the design leader of the two cars, has two extremely dramatic features. It has a full-width lighting, functional lighting unit across the front. The designers were convinced that the days of the grills are gone, the traditional grill. I mean, we don't really want to take the air in there anyway. It's not good aerodynamically, you know. We want to bring all the air in under the bumper if we can. And that these so-called grill shells were just sort of a remnant of the past that didn't mean anything. However,
getting smaller and smaller as the years go on.
Yeah, but we realized that, even though we know that the average American buyer likes to see something up there. It has a lot to do with the identity of the car.
Yes.
I mean, that front end, the grill, has a lot to do with it. So we knew we just couldn't take the grill away and leave nothing there. You needed something that represented a front end for the average buyer. So the designers developed this concept of putting a functional lighting unit between the headlamps. So in other words, you get on the Mercury, we'll have a full-width light bar, functioning light bar, very distinctive, very aerodynamic.
At what point in the
very functional?
At what point in the hood?
It's the leading edge of the hood. It would be in the position that you'd normally find a grill.
Okay.
But it's just a very smooth, continuous one-piece lighting unit, stretching from side to side, wall to wall, really.
That's something
very dramatic.
Very new in terms of.
I haven't seen it before.
Bulbs.
Well, we're using our flush headlamps that we pioneered the use of on our 84 Mark.
Mm-hmm.
The center lamp unit will be a constant running lamp, which I think is a nice safety feature, and also it'll have a redundant park and turn function.
Okay.
So it's functional and it's aerodynamic and it's very attractive.
Sounds
too.
Great.
The other feature on that car that's I think will be a first for the industry is the fact that the greenhouse, the roof of the car is almost has a glass that wraps all the way around from the backlight. The rear window wraps all the way around into the side glass and all the way forward to the A-pillar. So the whole rear portion of the roof is in effect glass. Very good aerodynamically too. There was one car that we developed in that program that never saw the light of day. I still feel badly about it. After we'd finished the two sedans, and they're both four-door sedans, by the way, the next stage was to develop a station wagon. And our designers worked up a rationale that Ford Motor Company didn't need any more boxy, functional station wagons, that we needed a high-style station wagon, because we have a new small vans coming out for the guy who wants a lot of package space. We have an Escort station wagon, which is a nice little functional wagon. We, at that time, were still entertaining the maybe continuing with our full-size LTD station wagons for a while. So we thought there was a niche there for a very stylish station wagon. And we set the objective that we would do a station wagon that you could take it to the lumber yard on Saturdays and get a 4x8 piece of plywood in there Saturday afternoon. But you could take it to the London Chop House for dinner Saturday night, and you wouldn't be ashamed of it, you know. Because most people buy station wagons because they have to, not because they want to. And we wanted to do one that people bought because they wanted it. And on top of that, we wanted to do the most aerodynamic station wagon in the world. So we did some wind tunnel testing, and we developed a profile, a silhouette for a station wagon that had an extremely fast rear window, almost a fastback design, and very rounded. And we found that we could achieve a coefficient of drag with the wagon of 0.29, which is very, very low. And we were certain that we had the lowest drag of any 8-passenger car in the entire world. We were certain of it. And on top of that, it was beautiful. And because the backlight was sloped, the air stayed attached to the backlight all the way to the bottom. So there would never be any buildup of dirt on the backlight, which is unusual for a station wagon. Needless to say, it was a dramatic departure from the traditional Ford Country Squire station wagon, as you can imagine. And that combined with this all-glass front end, you know, the full-width lamps, and it was a really dramatic piece of work. We worked hard to sell that design. There was some concern that because of this fastback design, there wasn't enough interior room. We wanted a third seat in there, a rear-facing third seat. We wanted to be sure. Mr. Poling, who's a golfer, insisted that he get 4 bags of clubs.
Red Poling,
into the rear.
4 bags?
4 bags, yeah. So two couples can go play on the weekend. So we built a cardboard mock-up of the entire rear of the station wagon. It included a lift-up tailgate. It included the rear seat, the fold-down rear seat, rear-facing third seat. And we gave a very good presentation to Mr. Poling and to Mr. Peterson. We had them sit in the car. We had them stacked up. We proved that the shape was at least as functional as a current one.
Who was working with you on this?
This would be Dave Turner, was the design manager of the exterior part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
There. And
you were the interior?
I was interior and exterior. I had both responsibilities.
That's right, yeah.
Dave was my exterior guy, and we had Mimi Vandermolen was the interior design specialist or head of the interior design group. So it was sort of a combined effort, this station wagon. And we had everybody signed up for this particular car. They agreed it worked. You can get in the rear seat. It was beautiful. It was aerodynamic. They said, fine, let's do it. It was the marketing group, really, that became concerned about losing a real lucrative piece of the market. And they asked us to develop a somewhat modified version of the thing that had a more traditional profile, without losing the real aerodynamic look of the car, but a more traditional side view. And they asked that we research it. I mean, I knew from the beginning we weren't going to win this, because they researched station wagon owners. Which station wagon do you like? Well,
yeah.
Station wagon owners have already made a decision that they want this kind of functional boxy thing. And no, they don't want one that looks like it has less room. And our contention was that this car would appeal to both the station wagon and the non-station wagon type of buyer. He would buy it because he liked it. Or he might be a guy who mainly wanted a sedan, but wouldn't mind a little more function if he didn't lose much style. So those were the people that weren't in the research. An interesting development since then has been that Audi has come out with an almost identical concept. Their station wagon is very, very similar to the concept we were considering.
Are they in the market in this country?
It is marketed now. Came in this year, or last year.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as good looking as ours, by the way, but it is the same concept. So that's a car that will never see the light of day, I'm afraid.
You've kept the sketches and...
Oh, we still have the fiberglass model.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, good. Hang on to that.
Yeah, it was an exciting concept. The whole program was exciting. Now, I'm really looking forward to seeing those cars when they finally come out.
The Taurus concept and experience would seem to be a almost a definitive example of the designer starting from scratch.
Mm-hmm. It is.
You've someone's ascertained that you've got to take a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
That you've reached a dead end, so to speak, or at least by 85 you need a new direction. and it, so there was, they, without the marketing people and without the product planners, you really sort of taken off, put the, brought this off by yourself.
Yeah, we've never had that much freedom, and the fact that we were responsible for both the inside and the outside of the car, we worked very hard to see that the two related, in, not only in terms of design philosophy, but in the actual, the forms and the shapes that we developed for the interior. We constructed properties that allowed us to put the interior designs in clay form inside a fiberglass version of the exterior very early in the program, so we could see how the total car worked as a unit, as an entity. There are some cars on the road, and we make some of them, whose interiors don't really match their exteriors. It happens sometimes, especially when you have split design groups like that. So we worked very hard to get that kind of a unity to these cars. And I think it works. They are dramatically different from anything else that's going to be out there. Not that they're strange. They're not. They're very well done, but they're just different. I mean, I have my fingers crossed about those cars.
This will be pretty much the first group that you've worked on as executive designer, interior and exterior.
Yeah.
Without fracturing or without diminishing your enthusiasm for the later period, can we move back in time to a more mundane portion of your career, perhaps, when you were working with the mid '70s Cougars in Montego,
mm-hmm.
and the Comets? Could you give us a sort of an overview of the design center at that time in terms of freedom of expression, in terms of administrative restrictions? Gene Bardonet is still very much in control at this time, is he not?
Gene is still very much in control,
yeah.
And you were always very much aware of his presence.
Yes.
Because
pervasive, really.
Pervasive, and he was always there. He seemed to have the time to spend in the studios. He would sort of circulate around when there was a very hot project. Gene would be there. He would be there from morning till night, you know. It was a very intimidating kind of a thing for a young designer. You know, he would sort of stand back, and in his very authoritative voice, he would say, "Fritz, would you put a line on that car over there? I'd like to look." And you know, you'd put this line, and your hands would be shaking, and you'd try and put this reasonable line on the side, you know. And he'd stand back.
Airbrushing?
No. This would be we put when we're developing a full size clay model. We'll put design lines on the side with black tape.
This is the taping process.
Thin black tape.
Yeah, right.
And it's a chance to review how a certain line might look in side view or a fender or in any view. So Gene was there. When there was a hot project, Gene was there. But there was still competition between the studios. The Montego program, this was during the Knudsen era,
mm-hmm.
at Ford Motor Company.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, you know, I'm seeing it from the fringe, of course. I was just a designer I was a design manager at the time, but my impression is that he came in like a whirlwind, really, the guy, and he had more interest in design than any other one I can remember in his position, except for maybe Lee Iacocca, but he seemed to be extremely interested in design, and he had kind of a shoot from the hip approach to approving designs. If he had a feeling that something was right, he would say, "That's it." He would come in very early in the morning, 7 o'clock, at these sunrise services, we called them, and he would walk through the design center kind of looking at everything, and occasionally he might stop, you know, he would come in behind a designer's board and sort of look at his sketches, you know, and it was very unusual. It was fun for everybody. I think it's interesting. I think we did some of our best cars, Ford Motor Company, or at least most successful, under his direction. I'm trying to think. We did, of course, the Montego Torino series of cars, which we built derivatives off of those cars for a number of years. We built the Torino Elite, series, which was sort of a reaction to the Monte Carlo. We built. We then did the 79, was it, Thunderbird and Cougar models, which were extremely successful. I think that's the Thunderbird that sold something over 250,000 units. Those were all derivatives of the Montego cars, with sharing a lot of sheet metal. At the same time, we did our bullet nose Thunderbirds, which were also very successful cars. He came in right at the approval time for the Pinto, and he made some dramatic changes. The car that had been approved prior to his arrival was, again, kind of a notchback design. It's a little unusual looking back on it now. Kind of a notchback, had a little small trunk, kind of a bustle back thing. And he asked that they look at some alternative rear end designs, and that fastback design was developed. And I think it tied the whole car together. It just, to me, that's a real classic, that original Pinto. From a design standpoint, anyway. And he was responsible for making, I think, a very important change to that car. He had a good eye for design. Mm-hmm. He also, he was responsible for the original Mark V, was it? I'm trying to think when that car came out. I can remember Mark IV. We were working on a design. We had a very large studio. I can't remember which studio it was I was in. And there were two marks being developed in the studio. One down at one end, sort of forgotten about, was being done by Wes Dahlberg, who was chief designer, an American, but had been in Europe for a while. He was chief designer of Germany. And he'd been back for several years, and he was doing his design way down at one end of the studio. And we were doing another one, and ours was Gene's favorite. So we had Gene there every day, and he seemed very happy with it. And because it was his favorite, he was pushing our design. So when Knudsen came through for his walkthrough, and these were very preliminary clays, they were dynocked. I guess if you know what dynock is, we do our designs in clay, in full size, but we have a material we call dynock, which is sort of a decal, sort of a material. It comes in large sheets. And it's a material that is painted with automotive paint, and it's applied to the clay, and it simulates a painted surface, a finish on the car, so it makes it look fairly realistic. So we will dynock the car as some color, and also we'll put some black dynock where the windows are to simulate the glass. And it's a very good simulation of what the car is going to look like when it's finished. Anyway, these cars were dynocked, and Gene was leading Mr. Knudsen in to look at our car, because he was pushing the design. And as he walked in, Mr. Knudsen looked down to the other end of the studio. You know, he said, "What's that?" And Gene, something like, "Well, that's another proposal, but that's not that." And he said, "Well, I'd like to see that." When he walked down, he said, "That's the car," and he bought it. And I don't think Gene ever forgave Wes Dahlberg for doing that good design. You know, the poor man, it wasn't his fault, you know. But he selected that car, and really, in retrospect, it was a classic, and that was the first, when that car came out, it was the first time we ever outsold the Eldorado. Uh-huh. It was remarkably successful. The Mark outsold the Eldorado.
The Mark IV?
I think it's the Mark IV. You know, I haven't followed that Mark lineage as closely as I should.
What were the differences between Dahlberg's design and your design?
There were worlds of differences. Ours was a very flamboyant kind of car with these very long, straight-reaching fenders, and we had some very exaggerated wheel flares that almost simulated this classic separate fender look. I'm really describing something pretty dramatic, I know. And the front end had a huge center grille with large lamps on either side of it. We had made the top kind of as low and as small as we could, so the proportions were extremely dramatic. It was sort of all hood and a very small greenhouse. You know, you just barely squeeze four people in there. Mm-hmm. And the usual spare tire on the rear. And it was a very hard-edged kind of a car, very crisp and linear. Mm-hmm. And very dramatic. It was a very dramatic shape.
Very much the mode at that time.
I wouldn't say it was the mode, but it sort of The Mark always made a rather strong statement. The Mark III definitely did. And it had this kind of classic overtone to it. And this car just took that and took it several stages further. But Wes's car was a more conservative design. It was a little bit more restrained, considerably more restrained, I should say. It was somewhat softer in feel. It wasn't quite as crisp and straight and linear. And it just had very simple wheel openings. Ours were very dramatic. They trailed back and tapered off. And wow, that was really something.
Still got the sketches?
I do, yes. Oh, I save those. I've saved these sort of milestone sketches, I call them, because they're so much fun to look back on. You know, I show the, I even have some photos of that particular car. Because when I show the young designers this stuff, I said, occasionally I'll be going through my files and I'll find all this stuff. I'll say, hey, let me show you something. I'll show you these cars. And they won't believe it. Times have changed so much. I mean, this car, it looks like it's about 30 feet long when I look at it. You know, it really does. It's just huge. And it's all hood. But this is very little. Proportions of cars have changed so much. I mean, now with the emphasis on this package efficiency, where the center body where the people sit is getting larger as it should, and the hoods are getting shorter, and the decks are sort of remaining.
You have to put jump seats on the hood.
Yeah, that was some car. That was fun.
What happened to Dahlberg, by the way?
I think Wes retired a few years after that.
The Bunky Newton era brought also another irritant for Bourdonnais in the person of Larry Chenault.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you remember much about that relationship?
Yes, well, yeah, and from the peripheral view, I do. But yeah, Larry Chenault sort of came along with, was brought in by Bunky Newton. I just assume that Larry Chenault was Bunky's favorite designer, and that happens sometimes, that people who aren't designers find someone that seems to think the same way they do. And so Larry came into the design center, and he was...
had a unique situation.
It was a very unique situation. He was made a director at the time, which was still is a very position. And kind of the young upstart. And in addition to that, he had this very special relationship with Bunky Newton. And it was a very adversarial relationship, this one between Larry and Gene. I mean, Gene is a kind of guy who's enjoys being in a position of authority, and he's used to it. And it must have been a very difficult period for him to have Larry there, as you know, my impression was, as kind of Bunky Newton's real design advisor. You always had the impression that Bunky would be asking Larry what he thought should be done. Must have been a very difficult time. And on top of that, Larry Chenault was a kind of a real character, one of the typical automotive characters. He was a very flamboyant guy, very outspoken, sort of salty language upon occasion. And he started this, he wore these extremely brightly colored shirts. They were almost a day glow. I don't know where he got these things. But he had brilliant yellow shirts and red, you know, and green, and just these intense colors with these wide ties were in this fashion at the time. I can remember that. This combination of this sort of this strong personality and the fact that he was a bit of a character, and the fact that he had this sort of political ace in the hole, it was a very interesting period. Looking back, I'm not sure exactly how long that period lasted. It was a couple years. I only know that after Bunky Newton left the company, and I think the next day Larry Chenault left the design center, that was it, you know. I'm sure Gene was glad to get that burr out from under his saddle. But it was an extremely creative time period. I mean, that we talked about competition, but that was a whole different kind of competition going on there. Intense, and all the political overtones instead of it. But on top of that, I do remember, as a designer, finding it a very exciting time. And the fact that Newton was a real automotive guy, and he really appreciated design, and I think he made a lot of good design decisions. It was not an unpleasant time to be a designer relatively on the board. It wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It was fun, as a matter of fact. Because you're really, those things that we talked about really aren't, don't affect you as a designer very much.
Right. Who was running the design studio besides Bourdonnais at this time? Who were the administrators?
You mean the other directors? Basically?
Basically, yeah.
Gee, let's see if I can remember.
This would be in the early, mid to late 1970s.
Yeah, well, Dave Ash was still there. He had Interiors at the time.
He was director of Interiors.
Director of Interiors. Let me think. Don Della Rosa was director of an advanced area, I believe. Don Kafka was still an exec at that time, I think. I really can't remember.
Creative Stylist?
Yes.
In charge of what?
I don't remember. It's amazing I'm having trouble remembering these people. I'm not sure if Joe Orris was still there or not. You know, I really can't remember. Isn't that the strangest thing?
Not surprising.
It was a period of change.
Mm-hmm.
And chronologically, I can't put it together. I know there was a time when Joe Orris was sent to Europe and became vice president of design over there, and then he retired from that position. He came back for a year or so and then retired. Buzz Grissinger left somewhere around that time. I know Dave left shortly after that.
A certain amount of upheaval.
Looking back on it, I guess there was.
Older designers are leaving.
Yeah. It's so different now. I mean, the I guess you call it the new breed is in place, and or most of them are, and they're different. It's a different place now. It's more professional. It's more serious. It's less flamboyant. There are fewer powerful personalities, I guess. Those guys were really characters. Each and every one of them, you know. That's what made the place exciting in a way. That those personalities.
In the 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Jean Bardonet seemed to survive many of the political currents swirling around his head in those days, even surviving the nudes era.
Certainly.
Obviously a man of parts in terms of administrative ability and design savvy. Who I understand brought the design center back into the 20th century in terms of function. And what's your impression of him overall? I think I've asked you this earlier, but I'm thinking now of your impression of him as the 70s draw to a close, and what happened in terms of fashion and design.
Mm.
Why he seemed to leave somewhat abruptly.
I think he was a remarkable guy, you're right, and I don't think Ford Motor Company could have found a better guy to head up the design department through the 70s. And he was able to generate the kinds of designs that were extremely successful through the 70s. And it was a time of flamboyance, and Gene had that. And he seemed to have an extremely good rapport with Lee Iacocca. He seemed to have an extremely good rapport with the with Henry Ford himself and William Clay Ford and the family. And I guess my impression was that he was just in real solid, and had a lot of political support. But on top of that, he just seemed the right guy for the kind of cars that we were doing at the time and the kind of pace that we were working at. But it was that period when the trends began to change, in the late 70s and 80s, where the designers, there was a sense among the designers that, I joked a little bit about this, the Gene's edict about fenders will never be anything but level, you know. He became so stubborn, it seemed, about not changing. He had the impression that he wasn't comfortable with the changes, that he was comfortable with a certain type of design. He understood it and he was good at it. But that this change somehow was a threat to him. I had that feeling. That it's the strangest thing. And he became sometimes so adamant about doing things his way. I can remember, I worked on the new Escort design. That was one of mine too. The 81? Yeah. And we all felt the car should have a little bit of wedge to the belt. It should run downhill to the front, just a little bit. And Gene said, no, Fritz, I want that belt level, level. So we leveled out the belt, because of the way the car sat on the ground, we felt that it needed a quarter inch of rise to the rear so it wouldn't look like it was dropping to the rear. And Gene came in and he said, did you level that belt? And I said, yeah, yes, sir, I did, but I left a quarter inch of rise in it because it needed that or else it would look like it was falling to the rear. And he said, I told you to make that belt level. No, I want it level. Now, we brought the bridge up, which is a measuring device, and we drew a line on the side of the car, which was absolutely flat, level. And he said, now that's what I want. Thank you. And he left. And to me, that's just an example of being so hard-headed about a philosophy that when I see the car on the road today, I don't know if you'll notice this now, I hope, that the belt line or the bottom of the window line runs downhill to the rear on that car. It's wrong, you know. It has the wrong attitude. But it just represented that kind of resistance. So there was a period of several years when it was obvious to all of the designers that the fashions were changing, that cars were changing dramatically. And Gene just resisted. He just resisted that change. He wouldn't let it happen. I mean, all these edicts about fenders should be straight and belt lines shouldn't, and the wedge is dead, you know, that used to be another thing. He just seemed to resist change. And I think that sort of opened the door for guys like Jack Telnack, who were sort of represented the new breed, Don Kopka, who seemed to be up to date and were willing to look at the new things that the designers wanted to look at. It just seemed like Gene hung on so long to what he knew was successful, that worked, that you were conscious that management was wanting change, that everybody wanted this change, and that Gene wouldn't let it happen. It was a very awkward period because I was working for Jack Telnack at that time, sort of the young upstart Jack Telnack, and we were doing these new kinds of cars, and it was obvious Gene didn't like them. And Gene would go off to another studio and have them do a competitive car in his style.
I would then have them review?
Well, because of the management team at the time, it was either Bill Burke, and I forget who came in after him, our designs were still selected. But of course we all worked for Gene, and those modifications were made to them like the one I described, in spite of that.
Sort of a rear guard action.
Yeah, there was kind of an internal upheaval, and really we were just, it was so obvious that the designs needed to change, they really did, that these hard and fast rules that this is good design and this is bad design were should be changing, and they weren't. And I think, you know, I look at the straw that may have broken the camel's back, I think, was in a period when we were downsizing and all very conscious of...
What period was that?
Well, it must be the late 70s, okay. Early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure when Gene did retire.
80.
Okay. It was at that period, late 70s. And, you know, we had the fuel crunch and the whole industry was downsizing and the emphasis was on just a different approach to design. It was at that time that Gene had a special Mark V? Built for himself at a supplier's, where they took the Mark and they cut the car between the front wheel and the windshield and extended it 13 inches. So the car had an exceptionally long hood to begin with. They extended the hood another 13 inches, the whole front end of the car. They chopped the top of the car and made it somewhat smaller. And in addition, they installed these large chrome fake exhaust pipes, you know, out the side of this thing. And it really represented, I think Gene was saying, I don't give a damn what the rest of the world is doing, you know. This is the kind of car I want to have. This is the way cars should be. And he would park that in his parking spot. Now, at the same time, Jack Telnack was parking up front, and he would drive a little Mustang, you know. And the contrast was so dramatic. I'm sure Jack was very aware of what he was doing too, you know, very clever. But here was this car, and it sitting out in front of the design center, and it said to the world that this is the kind of stuff I believe in, and I'm not going to change. And to me, you know, I look back on it, and Gene was just saying, I dare you, you know, to do something about this, because he was a powerful
almost
guy.
Suicidal.
Well, looking back on it, I would say yes. He certainly wasn't flexible to change. And he was even sending the Ford of Europe. At this time, the Ford of Europe, I told you I was sent over to Europe in the late 60s.
Right.
To help them out. Well, they've come a long way since then, and because they've gotten a head start on this aerodynamic thing and some of the other design trends, they were now sort of in the lead from a design standpoint. We were looking to them for a while for design inspiration. And they were designing a new European Granada at the time. And Gene had a European Granada brought over here. It was a facelift, so we could use the basic body. And he grafted a front end on it that had this sort of a Mark-type grill shell, you know, and he extended it a good 6 inches. And I'm not sure he put the pipes on it, but he sent that thing over to Europe, you know, sort of as a proposal for the new program. You know, you look back on that and you wonder why he did that. It was such an incredible, unsensitive thing to do for him, but he did that. And that, so he was really taking a hard line on what he believed in at that time. Almost suicidal, I'd say, yeah.
Things were getting, in terms of his relationship, Coca had left.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Ford II was leaving.
That's right.
And a new generation of executives were in the saddle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the era was sort of passing him by.
It was.
Of his influence and input.
Yeah, and yet, in retrospect, I don't think he had so many strengths that he could have adapted. I mean, Bill Mitchell hung in there at GM for over, you know, for a long, long period of time. And he seemed to adapt very well to the changes at General Motors.
Perhaps you could tell us on exactly what input Bordnay did have on the present generation. Just before leaving.
Let's see.
I believe the Tempo Tokaz program was mm-hmm. underway at this point.
Yeah, it was, and that's another program I didn't mention, but the program I worked on.
Tell us a bit about that. That makes a good case history of the 2 points.
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact, because Gene had worked very closely in the early stages of that Tempo Tokaz development with the design group. And they had developed a proposal